Woman. Welcome to the Rich Black Woman Podcast, where we empower you to be rich in mind, body, and bank. It's your girl Yaz, and I'm here with a dear friend, and her name is Dani Smith Mathis, and she's here to talk to us about Domestic Violence Awareness Month or Intimate Partner Awareness Month in this month of October. And we'll be sharing from a very personal and real story. And we'll also be talking about why this is relevant to Black women here in the U.S., but Black women at large, and also to women globally. Dani is a graduate of Carnegie Mellon University, where she currently serves as a member of the University Alumni Association Board. She is a four-time co-author of several books. One of my favorites, Shut 'Em Down, Black Women, Racism in Corporate America. Everyday Struggle, How Toxic Workspaces Impact Black Women. That's something we can all unfortunately relate to. Her War II, an anthology of stories by military women and their families, and Survivors, Celebrating Life Beyond Domestic Violence. She is also currently writing her first solo piece that pays tribute to several of her mentors, including the late Wilma Rudolph, Arthur Ashe, and August Wilson, to mention a few. Dani Smith Mathis, welcome to the Rich Black Woman Podcast.
Hey, yes. Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Yes. Well, I'm really grateful for this time that you've allowed us to sit and listen at your feet about your experience, your own personal experience. And I really just want to say thank you, because with such a difficult and challenging topic, sometimes people may not be willing to share that. And so for you to be able to share some of your learning, some of your experiences to help other women who might be listening to this story, to this testimony, and glean from it some nuggets to strengthen themselves. And if they are in a similar situation, or if they have a friend, a family member who finds himself in a threatening situation such as intimate partner violence and domestic violence. So thank you.
Oh, you're more than welcome. I really am honored to be here, for sure.
Yeah. And so I know I wanted to start off with you sharing a little bit what you would like about your experience with intimate partner violence. And also we'll get into a few more details and nuggets, because we want to leave women empowered and sharing with them maybe some learnings from that experience that could help them. So tell us what you want, kind of what's been your experience with intimate partner violence.
Well, first of all, I want to encourage everyone to be safe in their discussions of it, in their research of it. And I also thank everyone for listening. And thank you, Yasmin, again, for holding space on this. My experience was not based in intergenerational cycle of violence, where as a child, I saw violence growing up and I accepted it and I condoned it. I never heard about it. I never saw it because it didn't exist, not because anyone was hiding it. Didn't see it in my extended family. I am the eldest of three girls, and I'm the eldest grandchild on my mother's side, second eldest on the second set. I say all of that on my father's side. And I say all that because firstborns have a tendency, from my own experience, to be very obedient and they trust authority. So that was never a problem for me going into a marriage, where I actually married my tennis partner when I was an undergrad in Pittsburgh. I married my tennis partner. We were not intimate. We were just tennis partners. And over time, and through lots of long distance letters, we got to know each other and then eventually got married. And it was very interesting long distance courtship. But what I did see growing up, before I came to know him as my friend and then eventually as my husband, was I saw marriages. I saw good, healthy relationships. So I knew what that looked like. I knew what that translated into for me as a child, as a grandchild. My grandparents on both sides were married over 70 years. My parents were married over 43 years. I saw what men looked like who loved and cherished their wives. I saw women who were mothers and stay-at-home moms and work outside of the home moms like my mom was, but who were also very clear about who they were, even though they served their husbands. So that is what I was used to. That is what I looked up to. That was my dream, to have that kind of relationship. Early on in my marriage, however, there were some incidences, and one in particular that I remember my husband at the time had a very, very strong reaction to something he didn't like that I did that was very simple, as saying, I don't want dessert right now. And so what you have to understand is that as a person who experiences that at the time as a victim, I do not call myself a victim anymore because I've healed from it, and I'll talk about that in a minute. But it's very important when you're in this to understand that you're not the one who is the issue. When someone has a problem with you, it's going to be because they have a problem with themselves. And they just really literally take stuff out on you. And it goes in cycles. And so I really got to a point where I realized that I was in a problem marriage, and I didn't get out because I didn't want to get divorced, Yasmeen. I didn't want to be the first generation of folks getting divorced in my family. And so I stayed longer than I should have. I know that now. I withstood things that I should have never tolerated. But at the same time, I had children that I did not want to be involved in a legal system. And so that is why I stayed. And so I think people don't, what I would like people to understand from a brief conversation about it is the ways that families and friends can help is to really talk and not be afraid. A lot of times people are just afraid to get involved because of they don't want to be involved in mess. They just don't. They don't want to be involved in mess. And they certainly don't want to be involved in physical mess where people are, you know, involved in physical violence. And I can understand that. So I think I'll stop there and maybe have you ask me some questions if you'd like.
Yeah. Thank you for that summary and that background of, you know, your history. Because I think a lot of people can relate to the fact that it doesn't mean because you find yourself in one of these situations that you were a part of a generational issue where this had been seen before and you were acting out and following a script. So I really appreciate that you basically shared how this could happen to anyone. Yeah. And I loved, Danny, that you pointed out that this is not a problem with you as a woman. Right. It's not a problem with whoever's the victim in that relationship. It is, to your point, it is a problem that that individual has. And like you said, they're taking it out on you. And thank you for clarifying that and putting that punctuation mark there, because I think a lot of women are taught to think, well, there's something wrong with me. I'm not doing something right. Mm-hmm. I've messed up.
That's right.
And it's so clear and evident that no, actually, there's an issue with the other individual who is doing these violent things to you, whether they be emotional violence, right, physical violence, it's all violence.
Right.
What would you say to talked about, and I'd like you to tease out people to talk more about these issues. So what would that have looked like for you? Mm. What would that have looked like if you wanted somebody to talk more about it? Would it have been people like, maybe you can share, was there anybody in your family that you think knew what was going on, yes, but didn't say anything? And yes, what could they have done?
Well, clearly there were people that suspected that their things were not all good on the Western Front. And when I did share it with someone that I trusted, I shared it as a concern about the behavior that I'd seen. The first time I'd seen anything, I was shoved into an appliance. And if that was the strong reaction to just something simple as not wanting to eat a birthday dessert because it was too late and I don't like to eat dessert late. And I don't know why that reaction was so strong, but see, people that are the perpetrators have control issues, and they also think that they're entitled to abuse you. So when I saw this, I did go to someone, and it was actually my my former husband's fraternity brother. And they had lived together for years during their time in undergraduate school. And I said, and I actually went away for a weekend, and this fraternity brother was like my own brother. And I said, listen, this is what's going on. Have you ever seen this behavior before? And he emphatically said no. And I figured, well, if, you know, you're that close to someone and you've lived with them and you've not seen this kind of anger to this degree before, then this was just a minute. This was just a bad night, bad day. And that's what I chalked it up to. But the thing I want to clarify, Yasmin, to your question is, I don't know that I wanted people to talk to me, because I wanted to figure it out for myself. I think at times when, although I know now it wasn't me, I didn't always feel that way. And I was thinking, well, maybe I am doing something wrong. Maybe if, you know, if I just do this or clean the house better or fix a better meal, or I don't know, you can make so many excuses for perpetrators. And that is a problem within us as the victims at the time we are being victimized, is that we do make excuses for these people. And I know this happens to men as well, but I'm going to speak from what I know as a woman having been victimized. So when you think it's you, a lot of that is all is on you. This takes time to understand that it isn't you. I didn't sit in a relationship thinking, I know this isn't me all the whole time. I was in a 26-year marriage where this was going on and off and on and off and on and off. And the reason why it was on and off was because he traveled for his job. So when he was gone, it was off. When he was home, it was on. And as he traveled more, it was less on, you know, and then at those points in times, I was learning how to deal with it because he was gone a lot. But I think if someone had asked me at any point in time, what is going on, I might have been receptive. But no one asked, because people don't want to get involved. I mean, there were times when I called the law enforcement, and sometimes they would write false reports. And so you stop caring about the truth of the matter because of many different variables. And no, this is not a situation where you have time to think. Sometimes you have to just do what's right and best for your life at the moment, or for your children's safety at the moment. And so a lot of times I got into situations where I didn't say anything because I didn't want it to come back to haunt me. I didn't want him to come back on me for having said something. So this is not something that is talked about by the person who is being victimized, because oftentimes we are afraid of what that might be.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing that and the complexity of it. And that's why it is so, so difficult. But I like that you emphasize, and the reason why I asked is because I think you're right. We don't ask. We're too scared to ask. We don't want to offend. We don't want to, as you say, get involved. And we know that there's a lot of potential backlash and fallout, even for that person who is the victim.
Yes.
If I say anything and they find out, will they get punished?
Mm-hmm.
What does that look like for them? So figuring out perhaps different ways to let the person know maybe that they're there, or that they observe something is a little off, or speaking in code. I don't know, but it seems like we should at least make some type of attempt, and maybe covertly, obviously want to do it with safety in mind for that person and for ourselves and our families as well. But to your point, you would have appreciated somebody at least asking. Do you think, Danny, you would have been honest if somebody asked?
Yes.
Hmm.
Yeah, I would have been.
Yeah.
Would have been, because part of it is, you know, my nature, number one. And I'm not saying that I would have disclosed everything.
Yeah.
But I would have been honest. And I may have spoken in code.
Yeah.
And let me tell you how I know that's true. I'll give you an example. One time every time I went to the emergency room, one time I was almost fatally wounded. And I was, it was on my birthday. Nothing ever good happened on my birthday. It was just amazing. Like I was, it's just crazy.
Wow.
But I remember being thrown out of my house one night with no shoes on. It was middle of the night. It was 12 inches of snow. This was when we lived in New Jersey. And it's February. 12, it had a snowstorm, thrown out of my house. I never could tell you what the arguments were about.
Right.
I never understood it. And I will say that I do recall that night I was freezing in that snow. I had no shoes on. And so I broke back into my own home because I just broke a window. There was a key inside the window that I broke, the key right inside of the door. I let myself back in. And I remember my ex-husband came towards me and he just picked me up and he threw me into the tiled wall in the kitchen and my head busted open like the Rock of Gibraltar. And I had three small children sleeping at the time. It's midnight. And all I kept thinking was, God, I got to get this blood up because I don't want them to see it. If I'm not here, will I ever see my children again? And I called my pastor and his wife. And because I did not want to call the police because I wanted someone with me that I knew. And
yeah.
I wanted them to call the emergency technicians for me. And they did. And it was so much snow on the ground that they couldn't come. I lived on a dead end street that they couldn't even come down a dead end street with the ambulance. They had to walk down, get me, walk me back up. They put me in the ambulance. I go to the hospital. The man asked me in the hospital, oh, man, what happened? So to your question, to your point is, would I have been honest? Well, I was always honest. But what I said to him was, I was pushed. We never speak in active voice. We always speak in passive tense, passive voice, because it was what happened to us as opposed to who did it. And I remember there was another time that my ex-husband slammed a phone down on my hand and I had a contusion on my left hand. And I went to the emergency room the next day because my hand was in so much pain and he took me. And because that starts the honeymoon cycle is when they start to feel bad about what they do when they see you suffering sometimes. And they'll try to make themselves feel better by helping you to go get help in an emergency room from something that they did, right? Like that's even a crazy conversation that we're having. And I remember now, mind you, the difference between the first incident and the second incident was about a span of 2 years, I think. And that incident happened 2 months before O.J. Simpson was found not guilty for killing his own wife, right? And I remember I walked into the emergency room and two doctors were looking at me and I could tell they knew. I could tell they knew what happened to me.
Yeah.
But at the time, it was not required of them as medical professionals to ask me that. Now it is.
Yeah.
Now it is. But had I gone 3 months later or 2 months later, they would have asked me that question and I would have had to have told the truth. And
wow.
So when they asked me what happened, I said, a phone fell on my hand. Now, technically it did, but someone slammed it on my hand. So you always protect the perpetrator because you do not know if it's going to come back to haunt you.
Yeah.
And you are particularly mindful of that if you have children, small children who are still not of legal age and the state could take from either one of you or give to him if you'd separate, divorce or whatever. I just didn't want that. So I kept quiet.
Yeah. Well, it makes sense. And you're so right. And thank God that some of those laws have changed and we have more awareness. And so women are given that screening question mm-hmm. and allowed to answer. We've come a long way, but not far enough.
Yes.
What advice would you give to your younger self? Obviously, being in a 26-year marriage it's a significant amount of time. And you had no idea this was going to be part of that future. And what would you say, looking back at that little girl who had all of those hopes and dreams and had such a great model of what marriage was intended for?
This is a very, very difficult question for me. And that's my honest answer. And the reason why it is so difficult, because I have three beautiful children from this marriage. And so my head would tell me from that very first incident, which happened 3 months before our wedding, I shouldn't have married him. That's what my head tells me. But my heart says now in doing it, you know, I had those children and I had children not immediately. I mean, I got married. I had my first child was three and a half years into our marriage, you know, so I didn't have children immediately. And there were incidences long before I had started having children. And in fact, I was beaten with two of my three children in utero. So I would have say to myself, leave sooner and just trust God for what he can do. Leave sooner.
Yeah, that's really simple yet profound advice.
My God, it took me from that first incident where I was taken away in an ambulance, I stayed another 16 years and it never got better. It just never got better. It wasn't as pronounced when my sons got older and stronger, and they were able to make it very clear that what would happen if they saw that it happened to me again from when they were younger seeing it. And then, of course, the travel I had mentioned, you know, my ex-spouse was doing a lot of traveling as the children got older. So I was with them most of the time, like 5 out of the 7 days a week, I was with them just as the single parent. Solo parent. I wasn't single, but I was a solo parent. I would say to myself, leave sooner, trust God for the rest.
Leave sooner, trust God for the rest. Set wisdom in that. I wanted to know, what was the breaking point? What finally gave you the strength to leave?
You had mentioned about in a previous question not too long ago about, you know, the little girl and me and my ideal for marriage. And I knew it was wrong for me to be abused, but I knew marriage was a good thing. And so I had godparents who were going to celebrate their 60th wedding anniversary in New Jersey. And we were both invited, my ex-husband and I. And he chose not to go and I wasn't going to miss it. So there we weren't in agreement, right? And I remember as I was packing for this trip, he was instigating the fact that I was going and I was leaving him. And, you know, they gaslight you. They make things out to be in a realm in their own mind that you're just not even thinking about, like, oh, you just want to get away from me or whatever. Like, yeah, I mean, maybe that was true now that I look about it. But I was just, you know, I was going to my godparents' wedding anniversary. I didn't look at it like I was trying to get away from my husband at the time. So trying to have that conversation with someone who is being irrational is not a conversation that can be had in a rational way. So I chose to move myself physically from the room where this conversation had initiated. And I moved into our guest room at the time, and he continued to follow me and egg me on. And really, I just wanted to have an argument. He wanted a reason to abuse me. And I remember at that point saying, I'm not falling for this anymore. I'm just not going to do it. And I stood my ground with him verbally, and I said, please let me just pack and do this in this room. And because we know where this goes, like, come on, give me a break. Right. And I remember he punched me in the arm. He told me he hoped I died on the trip. He called me out of my name. I won't mention what he called me at the time. And then the breaking point, Yasmin, was he spit in my face. And I remember right then there, and I was in a guest room that had only one way in and one way out. And I had to go past him to get out. And I remember saying, when he spit in my face, I said, okay, if I don't get out of this marriage, I'm going to die in it.
Yeah.
I'm going to die. Because for me, that was the turning point, because I don't care what you say. If a person spits on you or in your face or anything, they have a degree of hate for you that is inexplainable.
Yeah.
But for a moment, it's a moment too much for me. So that was my breaking point. And this is also very critical, Yasmin, to the discussion, is at the point in time when a woman decides to leave, it's the unsafest point of time in that cycle. And I knew that. So I had to move in silence until it was time to say, checkmate. And the way I did that was I went to New Jersey and I started telling people what I was going to do. And when I'm talking about people, I mean my maid of honor and somebody, a couple of other people very close to me. I got some counsel and I said, okay, this is what's about to happen. I'm leaving. And so I needed someone to know what was going to happen. And that's when I got the courage to do it. And I didn't know what was going to happen. I hadn't ever left a marriage before. But here's the thing. I still didn't want a divorce because I felt as though And I came back and I said that to him. I said, listen, I am not going to stand for this anymore, but I am willing to stay with you if you admit you have a problem, go get help for the problem and stop abusing me. And he made it very emphatic that the only way that that was going to happen is if we got out of each other's lives. And I thought, oh, okay, that was very clear to me. So I knew I had to go. So I separated. And I separated while he was on a business trip, a 4-day business trip. That is what I did. He was on a 4-day business trip. And I I was a coach at the time. I went to one of my athletes' moms who I had spoken to about it because she was actually a former policewoman in New York. And I started feeling more comfortable about opening up about my situation with certain people. And I left. And then eventually he served me divorce papers and I let him go.
Yeah. Wow. That took a lot of courage. And would you say, looking back, it was easier than you thought?
No, it was the hardest thing I ever did. It was the hardest thing I ever did because I had no money. Because here's the other thing. In a domestic violence situation, there can be financial abuse.
Yeah.
And my son, who was the last one to leave for college, reminded me, said, you know, Mom, Dad stopped paying for groceries when I was a senior in high school. You had to hustle and do your thing. You know, I was a realtor. I was hustling up stuff and, you know, doing my writing on the side and teaching and doing all these things because, see, I was a stay-at-home mom for 23 years doing all of this, 15 years doing all of this. So of the 26 years we were married, 15 of those years I was raising my children at home.
Yeah.
So I didn't have the same kind of income as a working mom would have had. And so my hustle was a little different. It was a side hustle. And I couldn't do it all the time because I was rearing my children and I was homeschooling. And they didn't stay at home during high school years, but I was still very much in their lives because, again, their dad was traveling and I was a solo parent.
Right.
So, no, it was tough, but resources. I went to a place called Promise Place in Fayetteville, Georgia. They helped me to start putting my resume together. And then I was homeless for a time and I went to a women's shelter. I went to a domestic violence women's shelter.
And where were your children at this time? Were they with you?
They were in college. They were in college.
Okay.
And then when I wasn't in the women's shelter, I was with family members or friends, I should say, extended, like friends that are really like family who were in the area. And when my kids came home from college, like on spring breaks or breaks or whatever, they would come with me wherever I was. But at one point in time, I was in a women's shelter and they couldn't come because they were too old. So they had to go to other friends' houses. And it was eventually that they said, Mom, we're tired of moving around like this. You know, when we come home for the summer, we want to be with you, you know, because they were coming home for summer from college. And I was staying with another friend of mine at the time after I got out of the women's shelter. In fact, she took me out of the women's shelter. And eventually there was no room for my children when I went to her house, though. But they did come and spend, they came and had dinner with me every night. And my daughter, she stayed at college in the summer times. But yeah, eventually my best friend, who was my real estate roommate, my real estate office mate, I would say, she was my angel on earth. And she took a closing check and she handed it to me and she said, go get an apartment. Just start over.
Wow. Yeah. But to your point, what you said before, trust God for the rest, right?
Well, that was all of that was doing it. Yes. All of that was trusting God. I didn't know someone was going to hand me a closing check and tell me to start my life over. My own sister, she sold stock. And out of her portfolio and handed me a check one day. I went to see her. She took me to lunch. She said, here, go buy a car.
Wow. Yeah, that's beautiful. So speaking of your healing and your transformation and your independence, how have you worked to heal yourself? And what does that look like for you?
I believe God gave me the children that he gave me to show me, to help me understand the importance of forgiveness. I recall the moment that I wanted to share all of this with my children about me separating from their father because of all of this. I picked a neutral spot. I was living in Georgia. My sons were in school in Norfolk State at the time. And then my daughter was in school in Charlotte, college in Charlotte. And so Charlotte was the midpoint for all four of us. And so I got a hotel room one weekend and I told my kids, I said, listen, I'm separating. Here's why. They had seen the incidents of abuse, so they understood why, the why part, but they didn't understand what happened before they were born. And I said, now, listen, I don't care what I tell you. This man is still your father. And the Bible says, because I'm a Bible believing woman, and I believe in that seriously without apology. And so I'll speak without apology. And I said, the Bible says that if you honor your mother and father so that your days may be long on the face of this earth, and I want you to live long. And so you need to honor your father regardless. And I'm not saying condone what he does, but I'm not going to sit here and bash him in front of you and then ask you to honor him. So I learned the truth of the matter for me. What did I contribute to the situation? Now, I know that sounds antithetical to what I said about it's not your fault, but you do have to dig as far deep as you can in your inner being to say, what was that for me? For me, I had to realize that I idolized the institution of marriage. And God says, do not have any idols before me. I come before everything. And even though I'm a Bible believing Christian, I went to church faithfully. I pray. I read scripture. I memorize. I taught my children in the way they should go so that when they're older, they would not depart from it. I did all of that, but I was still idolizing the institution of marriage. Now, I was doing that subconsciously, and it didn't really hit me until I really prayed and asked God, like, if it wasn't me, what was it in me that made me stay? And it was because I didn't want to get divorced because I idolized the institution of marriage. Had I understood that about myself sooner, my outcome might have been different. My input might have been different in the situation, but it wasn't, and it's okay. When I came to the realization, I realized I had to forgive myself first. And then for me, whatever that it was for Danny, that's what Danny had to do. Then I was able to forgive my ex-husband because I really did start feeling sorry for him. Because anyone that can actually feel like they're entitled to misuse and abuse another human being has a very serious problem. So I didn't stay angry at him for that. I was more angry at not getting anything from the divorce than I was, you know. I mean, I'm just being real. But, you know, he didn't take care of me in that way. But why would I expect that after he had mistreated me in such a way? Like, how could I even expect that? So I think for me, it was forgiveness, because forgiveness is for you. It's not for the other person. You cannot. Let me tell you something. This is the bottom line about this. If you don't heal from people who hurt you, you will bleed on people who did not cut you.
Ooh, say it again.
If you don't heal from people who hurt you, you will bleed on people who did not cut you. Mm. And I was not trying to block that blessing for another man to come into my life.
I heard that.
So I had to get over it. I just had to. And it's not to say that it was easy. You know, when you have a scar on your head from having been thrown into a wall and having to get 6 stitches, it still hurts. Sometimes I have a pain that comes out of nowhere. And I can't sit and wallow in that, why that happened and why I still have that pain. I just wait for it to go away and I move on with what I'm doing.
That's so good, Danny. And thank you for sharing that and the transparency and the realness that it wasn't easy, but through the fire, you also were provided for through your sister, through your best friend, and through your children. Mm-hmm. And being able to release what had been done to you. And like you said, make way for the future and make way for good to come. Yes. I thank you so much for sharing your story. And I think it's a story that, unfortunately, a lot of women can relate to. And we need more women to be transparent because there's empowerment in that. I love what you talked about in regards to how you made subconsciously marriage an idol. Yes. And there's actually a woman, and maybe you're familiar with her work. She talks about this as well. And I'll bring it up because I know that you've mentioned your own faith. And she speaks to a lot of women who are in the Christian faith. And surprisingly, there are a lot of women, particularly, I would say, in a lot of different religious groups who are experiencing what she calls emotionally destructive marriages. And her name is Leslie Vernick. And she talks about how in certain faiths, there is this idolatry of marriage. And to your point, because there's also scripture that says, oh, God hates divorce, not understanding that God loves you more than the institution of marriage, that that is a blessing and that's a covenant between man and woman. But God doesn't love just the idea of marriage more than your safety, right? And so we can get that confused and misguided. So thank you for being transparent in that. I think a lot of women, when they hear this, it's going to click and they're going to go, oh my goodness, have I been putting this idea, this institution on a pedestal and putting my trust in that versus putting my trust, as you said, in God? Profound. Yes.
Hey, Yasmeen, do we have time for me to just share one more thing?
Yes.
So you just brought up a couple of good points, and I want to talk about this because I am very serious about my faith, but I'm not religious. I'm not a man-made faith type of person. This is coming from the Word of God, what I base my faith on. The reason I'm saying that is because I was in a church that excommunicated me because I left my husband, because they said I had no biblical basis for leaving him, even though he was abusing me. This was a Black Baptist church in Atlanta. Mm-hmm. So don't get it twisted. Everything is not what you think it is. And then so the church was my biggest disappointment. The church was my biggest disappointment and was not a safe place for me during my time of leaving. It was not a safe place. The second thing I wanted to, and the way I learned what I learned about myself was through the Word of God, because I've never sat up under a preacher talking about domestic violence in a church. I never had that experience. I haven't heard that sermon yet.
Right.
The next thing I wanted to say is, you just brought about how God hates divorce. Well, let me explain something to you, because I'm adamant about this. Malachi 2:15 says, yes, God hates divorce. But that's only part of the verse.
Yep.
The verse says, for this reason, God hates divorce. Now, you have to go back to, what is that reason? And if you read Malachi chapter 2, starting, because that's verse 15, you read all of the verses before that, it talks about, because you dealt treacherously with your wife and you have not treated her like the wife of your youth that I gave you, and you've done all of these things to her, and you've covered her with a cloak of violence. What do you think that is? And so
domestic violence, right there.
Right. And so God says, so for this reason, God hates divorce. So I did have a reason to divorce. Yeah. So people will take that verse out of context to be proponents of not getting divorced. But again, it's for this reason. It's for this reason. So what was the reason? You've got to take that stuff into context. I'm telling you, that's the key right there. And so I'm learning all of these things because I wanted to know, God, what do you say about this? I know this man does not have the right and cannot be right in doing what he's doing to me, but I don't understand it. What do you say about it? And it wasn't when I was starting to comb through the scriptures that I really realized that it's treachery. This is treachery. This is what God calls treachery.
Yes. Yeah. And thank you for elaborating on that. And thank you for sharing how you had to come to it on your own by reading the scriptures yourself. Because to your point, people do take things out of context and they're not looking at the before and the after and what was really being addressed. And so we just take two words, three words, and then people apply it like it's law.
Right.
And then they keep themselves in bondage that God had never intended for them to be in.
Right.
Thank you so much for that revelation. Truly, I think you just helped probably set some people free, honestly,
who
will be listening to
this. I hope
Where so. Can people, I'm going to get into a couple of resources. We definitely want to make sure that anyone who is experiencing intimate partner violence or knows of someone, hopefully some of the things you've taken away from this are getting safe, understanding it's not you, asking the questions if it's someone that you suspect, a friend, a family member, figuring out a way and a safe way to let them know that you know and to ask them how you can help them. We have so many more resources today than to what Danny mentioned. Even 20 years ago, folks go to the ER or visit a doctor to be even asked, are they experiencing domestic violence, and with the internet and safe houses. So one of the things we wanted to leave you with is definitely the National Domestic Violence Hotline number, which is 1-800-799-7233. 1-800-799-7233. I want to also leave you with 211. 211 is like the 411 for connecting you to resources, whether it be housing, whether it be you need support because you are in an intimate partner violence situation, food, jobs, employment, any type of resources, 211.org. It's also a phone number, just like you would call 911, you can call 211. That is another great resource. If you're in looking for safe houses, places where, to Danny's point earlier, you need a place to go in a safe way, and they make sure that you are protected. Also, legal aid is also another great resource, particularly if you need to ensure that you're taken care of, you need to get some advice, legal advice. It's free. Definitely check out legal aid. Are there any other resources that are top of mind for you, Danny, that you'd want to share?
Well, I do want to say that there's a book that I did a co-author called Survivor Celebrating Life Beyond Domestic Violence. And that book is available on Amazon. And I would advise everyone to get that book, because this book has a plethora of resources in it. It's just a whole, I would say most of the book is informational and getting help. And so I would definitely advise everyone to get Survivors Celebrating Life Beyond Domestic Violence. It's on Amazon, and 13 of us told our stories there. But like I said, most of that book is really about, it's a coffee table book. It's beautiful. It's not a horror story book. It is a beautiful book. My story is in there, the Danny Mathis story, Healing by the Sea. And there's resources in all 50 states. There's red flags of domestic violence. There's domestic violence stats and resources, dieting, healing, finances, budgeting, getting back on your feet on your finances. Big, 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 big deal. I'm still dealing with that. Yeah. So I would definitely grab that book, as, you know, sometimes you call it like the Bible of something. Well, I would say the Bible of domestic violence to me is Survivors Celebrating Life Beyond Domestic Violence. So that's
excellent. Excellent. Thank you for that resource. And we will leave it there. Danny, I want to thank you so much for opening up your heart and your journey to us. We wish you nothing but continued success, and you have truly overcome. I know that you have a fabulous job now. You're also an accomplished author, and I'm just grateful that you're in my orbit. So thank you.
Thank you, Yasmin, and thank you, everyone, and be safe, ladies and gents.
All right. And RBWs, live richly.